So in the closing months of 1970, a new wave of radical feminism in Japan began to draw attention in the media, a feminist movement which was quickly labeled Umandibu, or roughly women's lib. Like most of those outside the new movement, Ninagawa Masao, the male journalist who coined this new term, saw it as emanating from the United States, which may in part explain his assigning the movement a seemingly foreign moniker. I actually, in my larger project, I show that it's not really foreign and that it's actually a very Japanese word. The majority of women in the lib movement, however, saw their activism as rooted in their own life experiences in Japan, not in ideas or inspiration from abroad. While my own survey of pamphlets, newsletters, and other ephemera produced in the formative years of the movement in the early 1970s suggests the bulk of the writing in the DIB sphere to be essentially local in origin and focus, translations and summaries of reports, essays, and whole books from English did arguably occupy a significant part of DIB discourse specifically, as well as more mainstream discourse in the 1970s on issues such as, most notably, the social status of women, women's health, and sexuality. Although not all translation of American and other feminist writing during this period was carried out by Japanese feminists themselves, some women connected to the Lib movement and other feminist activisms at times actively sought out and translated writing they found to be particularly inspiring or otherwise potentially useful to women in Japan. The result of these translation projects was sometimes writing ideas and practices that had been radically transfigured to accord with local circumstances, further belying mass media portrayals of the DIB movement as a mere import and, by implication, out of place in Japan. Now, before discussing the translations and transfigurations that are the focus of my talk today, I'd like to pause here and explain briefly what I mean by transfiguration. I don't really have time to go into a great deal of detail about it, but I hope that it sort of conveys what I'm one of the things that I'm trying to do in my larger project. At its most basic, I use transfiguration to refer to a change in form in the process of crossing from one culture to another. In so doing, I'm drawing on both the term's constituent parts, trans or across, and figure form, as well as the meaning of the whole term, a change in form or appearance. The term transfiguration has, of course, had some rather dramatic uses, among the most notable being in reference to Jesus' change in form when speaking to Moses and Elijah on a mountaintop, and then far more recently in reference to what Professor Minerva McGonagall describes as, and I quote, some of the most complex and dangerous magic students, such as the then young Harry Potter, learn at Hogwarts Academy. Transfiguration as I use it, however, is in no way miraculous or magic, but it is at once very powerful and the effects of the workings of power, both within the cultures of origin and reception, as well as between the two. I borrow the kernel of my own use of transfiguration from Dilip Gaonkar and Elizabeth Povinelli, who used the idea of transfiguration as part of an effort to elucidate, quote, the circulatory matrices, both national and global, through which new discursive forms, practices, and artifacts carry out their routine ideological labor of constructing subjects who can be summoned in the name of a public or a people. They posit that more productive than continued attention to meaning and translation as a means to understand the workings of transnational flows would be a focus on circulation, transfiguration, and recognition of cultural forms. In my work, I develop their vaguely articulated idea of transfiguration into a heuristic device through which to elucidate cultural change resulting from transnational flows of ideas, of images, and of people. While Gaonkar and Povinelli never offer a definition of transfiguration, they use it to index processes of change. This initial change sets in forth motion ripples of change that do not end with a newly reinvented thing that has been transfigured. Thus, to me, a focus on transfiguration calls on us to examine the multiple effects of those changes. Moreover, if things are transfigured in transit from culture to culture, there must be actors who are engaged, consciously or unconsciously, in acts of transfiguring. Accordingly, my own use of transfiguration calls on us to identify agents of change and to query their motivations. Finally, transfiguration, as I use it, has no fixed direction or terminal point. These ripples of change can extend indefinitely in any direction, including back to the culture whence the transfigured thing originated or onto a third culture. Thus, an examination of transfiguration and the reproduction of cultural forms has no logical or fixed stopping point and might take us in surprising directions. I use transfiguration to move away from concepts premised on specific conditions on the ground that limit their interpretive potential. Very briefly, ideas or frameworks like localization, glocalization, Fernando Ortiz and later Mary Louise Pratt's transculturation, as well as hybridization, syncretization, and creolization, have all been used to illuminate cultural change and new cultural forms arising from flows of things and of people, and in the face of popular discourse that would see much of the world in the past as conquered, colonized, and controlled, and in the present as McDonaldized, Disneyfied, or Starbucked from above, these concepts have all shed light on the agency of individuals and communities, whether subalterns or alternative artists. Yet even when used judiciously, they tend, with some notable exceptions, to be used in such a way as to imply or assume a unidirectionality of cultural change, or that presuppose a post-neo or plain old colonial relationship. An examination of Japanese cultural history demonstrates that we should not presume either condition. Japan, which has been both the subject of and subjected to colonization, is sometimes, and falsely, seen as a particularly unique case, sometimes described as uniquely unique. Change arising from cultural interaction is as old as culture itself. And while power relationships between cultures are rarely, if ever, equal, I would suggest that we should be careful to allow for the ways in which cultural flows and concomitant changes are shaped by relations of power, and yet are more open-ended and diffuse than models like glocalization or post-slash-neo-colonial domination and resistance generally allow for. I do want to point out, however, that while I'm using transfiguration to highlight the agency of individuals to open up new spaces and new possibilities, as well in how in my larger project, though not really here today, how cultural flows can be multidirectional, transfiguration can also be applied to acts which seek to consolidate power and to limit the agencies of individuals and communities. And as for translation itself, which is my focus today, translation theorists such as Maria Timochko make a strong case for an expansive notion of translation that encompasses diverse processes and products across cultures and across time. I find it productive, however, to delimit translation to its more common definition of conveying in one language, however successfully, an utterance from another. While all translation is creative, André Lefebvre, for instance, describes translation as rewriting, it is important to distinguish attempts to directly transmit textual meaning or affect from attempts to transform it. This distinction speaks to both agency and intention and can have profound implications on the resulting text as well as, consequently, the effects of those texts. By positioning translation as a mode of transfiguration, we can expand our purview to include acts and products related to translation without losing this specificity. I see translation as one of an array of foci through which to elucidate transfiguration as processes of change through circulation in a given cultural context. In the case of the Umandi movement in Japan, in spite of its arguable significance, translation has not been given adequate attention in histories or other studies of this sphere. This I attribute in part to a reaction against the idea that Lib itself was foreign. The journalist Nina Gawa, who I mentioned at the opening of my talk, his own impression that Lib was made in the USA was perhaps reinforced, perhaps instilled in him by the fact that in the course of his research for what was the first of what was to become a series of articles on the movement in the mainstream daily Asahi Shimbun, he spoke with Akiyama Yoko, a member of a group which that summer had produced and began to circulate a pamphlet containing translations of several articles by U.S. Second Wave feminists, a pamphlet which had itself had served as a reference to Ninagawa. Now, in a memoir of her personal Lib history, Akiyama remarks that, quote, "We cannot ignore the influence of the American women's liberation movement on Japan's Lib movement. Translated information and ideas from the U.S., she observes, helped to inform, even ignite, quote, the smoldering resentment among Japanese women and to put that resentment into words. Nevertheless, the information that most Lib activists in Japan who began to come together in the summer and early autumn of 1970 had about their counterparts abroad came from the limited and distorted images available in the mass media beginning earlier that year, rather than from personal experience or from translation. And it was this combination of slant and silence in the mass media that Akiyama's own early co-translation project aimed to correct, a project which represents the Lib movement's earliest engaged translation. Tomochko describes engaged translations as those which are intended to, quote, rouse, inspire, witness, mobilize, and incite to rebellion, and which are created by engaged translators, who themselves have political agendas and use translation as one means to achieve those agendas. Of course, the pamphlet was made by a group of women who came together merely as a reading group. Its members did not set out to be or identify as translators, and one of the two individuals who did the actual translation was a man who was not involved in the group, and the other being Akiyama. The group's pamphlet was circulated informally in a limited sphere, and it seems that it was largely by chance that it played a significant role in the history of the Lib movement, specifically in its naming and framing in the mass media in late 1970. That following year, partial translations of two landmark collections of American Second Wave writing, Women's Liberation, Blueprint for the Future, and Notes from the Second Year, were published by commercial presses. That both appeared in Japanese the year after their publication in the US, and that the earliest of these was published less than 6 months after Japan's Lib movement began to attract the media's attention, indicates a clear measure of interest in and awareness of the American movement on the part of at least some individuals and on the part of some publishers. As I outline in greater detail in my current book project, the Japanese rendition of Women's Liberation, that's this one, the first of these two is not an engaged translation. The decidedly non-activist academics who rendered the volume into Japanese make no effort to indicate the sometimes drastic changes that they made to the original text. And in drawing no concrete connections between the volume and the lives of women in Japan, fail to offer the sort of blueprint for the future that the writers of the original volume had in mind. Nor have I encountered any evidence in the Lib sphere or elsewhere that the volume had much impact. By contrast, the Japanese version of Notes from the Second Year is clearly the work of engaged translators and reverberated in and outside the Lib community. These women translators, who call themselves the Wolf Society, in honor of Virginia Woolf, were both directly involved in the Lib movement and very overt about the interventions that they made in their translation to create a text of immediate relevance to women in Japan and ultimately to help bring about social change. In spite of crediting Shulamit Firestone and Ad Kot as the editors of the volume and themselves as merely the translators, they substantially and openly transfigured the text, translating in full or in part just 16 of the original 34 chapters that seemed most meaningful, then reorganizing them and inserting their own voices to frame them. They assigned the collection an entirely new title, From Woman to Women, a report from the American Women's Liberation Movement. This title simultaneously gestures to the plurality of ways to be a woman and positions the text as a message from American activists to their potential counterparts, as well as from the translators to other women in Japan. And in lieu of burying their comments on the text in an afterword, as is common in Japanese translations, the translators include a translator's foreword at the front of the book, and in the back insert an extended roundtable in which the translators discuss the text and the movement and relate that to their own life experiences. Akiyama also played a key role in the translation activities of the Wolf Society, which itself came together as a reading group under circumstances and with a composition of members similar to those who put together the earlier pamphlet that I mentioned. As with the first pamphlet, it was Akiyama who initially got her hands on the just-published Notes from the Second Year, which she shared with a reading group. These brave, bold, self-proclaimed radical feminists writing about sex, housework, and self-awareness had, quote, put to word feelings that had been smoldering in our hearts that now finally made sense. And so the nine members of the group set about to translate it, they write in their foreword, quote, because we wanted as many women as possible to read it. Based on the overwhelmingly positive and encouraging responses the translators received, the transfigured text was as inspirational to many of its readers as the original had been to its translators. In spite of an absence of significant advertising or reviews, readers around the country found copies of the book, upwards of 5,000 of which were sold, and sent the Wolf Society dozens of letters full of passion, desperately seeking information about Lib and solidarity with other women. And in the spring of 1972, the group produced the first of what were to be three issues of the Minikomi, From Woman to Women, that would be the red one, This new publication focused on some of the same issues as Notes from the Second Year, but was written with it from the perspective of women in Japan and tailored specifically to their concerns. With the first issue, the Wolf Society included a booklet containing letters from readers of their translation, creating a sense of dialogue between readers and translators, as well as readers with each other over the meaning of the translated text. This book also inspired a long-running minikomi out of Osaka, or minikomi, a zine, out of Osaka, entitled From Woman to Women, same title, hence the, you know, the connection. And like Notes from the Second Year, other translations of the key American second wave feminist works also sparked dialogues on issues such as women's bodies, sexuality, and reproductive health. Foremost among these was almost certainly Our Bodies Ourselves. Through a combination of coincidence and fortuitous personal ties, both within Japan and transnationally, three Japanese women came to take up one of the very first translations of this text, which was to become a landmark in the global women's health movement. Clearly, Japanese Lib activists were very much in the transnational feminist loop. With its emphasis on female sexuality and reproduction, including chapters on sexual anatomy, sexuality, rape, venereal disease, birth control, abortion, and childbirth, the book resonated with major concerns of the Lib activists. In fact, in the fall of 1972, at the suggestion of a couple of Americans then in Japan to protest the Vietnam War, the Wolf Society had already published an issue of From Woman to Women, focused on women and sexuality, divided into sections on abortion and birth control, pregnancy and infertility, as well as sexuality and the female body. Excerpts from which were reprinted in the mainstream of feminist-leaning women's magazine, Fujin Koron, in the spring of 1973. Although they wanted to translate the whole book, the three women who set out to translate Our Bodies Ourselves, which again included Akiyama, realized they needed to abridge it if it was to be cheap enough for ordinary women to afford. The new Simon & Schuster version, which had just reached them, was greatly expanded from the version they'd first read, and it included new chapters on nutrition, exercise, lesbians, aging, and medicine and society. Using the structure of the older version as a guide, the translators decided to concentrate on what they at the time felt to be the topics of the greatest urgency to women in Japan: the body itself, birth control, pregnancy, and childbirth. And they were committed to supplementing the translation with Japan-specific information. 10 months after a preliminary excerpt from Our Bodies Ourselves on the birth control pill was published in Fujin Koron in 1973, the Japanese translation was released, selling well enough to be reprinted several times. The Japanese version credits both the Boston Women's Health Book Collective and the three translators prominently on the cover of the book, retitled Women's Bodies, The Truth About Sex or Sexuality, and Love, a title chosen to more readily convey the contents of the book than would a direct translation of the English original. The very engaged translators make their presence visible throughout, from the foreword to the Japanese edition, which follows a translated greeting from the creators of the English version, to the brief annotations and supplementary information inserted throughout in dark brackets, to the two distinct afterwards they include in the back. In their foreword, the translators summarize the history of the and impetus for the American original, and like the translated letter from the Boston Women's Group that opens the book, they situate women's bodies as a collective project. While the translators are clearly reaching out to individual women across Japan, and their emphasis on the collective nature of the book's production is very much in keeping with the spirit of Lib. And to the translators, women's bodies, the product of their collective effort, symbolizes what the women involved on both sides of the Pacific hope, quote, is a new expansion and intensification of the movement. In the remainder of the foreword, the translators turn to Japan, which they explain has, quote, completely the same circumstances that drove the women in the U.S. to develop the book. Namely, in Japan, as in the U.S., the medical system has deprived women of both their feelings about and accurate information on their bodies. But, as the Boston group put it, knowledge is power, and the translators hope, through this project, to empower women in Japan. Following up on this, the first afterword explains that while there are many points in common between the medical systems in Japan and the U.S., there are also many differences. It exhorts women to take steps such as paying attention to their own bodies and asking questions of doctors to get the best medical treatment possible. In the translator's afterword, the three women describe their own encounter with this book as taking place, quote, in the middle of the expansive flows of the women's liberation movement, which links the United States and Japan. Within the DIB movement, the transfigured text became a major springboard for further discussions and published roundtables and articles, as well as teach-ins about women stealing back their bodies from gynecologists and obstetricians. And it can arguably be linked to the opening by feminists of a women's health center in Osaka almost a decade after its publication. Outside the DIB movement, women's bodies quickly reached even more readers in further transfiguration into two volumes of the popular Bassetts Takarajima series, Women's Dictionary and Women's Bodies, in 1977 and 1978. On the cover of both these books is the English subtitle, The New Women's Survival Guidebook. The volumes offer a more expansive lifestyle guide than the Wolf Society's translation, but openly draw on our bodies ourselves as well as its translation. Both these new transfigurations, as well as the original translation, are recommended in and served as a reference for a handwritten mimeographed guide to birth control methods produced in 1983 by students to prevent the worsening of the Eugenic Protection Law, an activist group formed as part of a larger response to new proposed revisions to the law, which would have, among other things, drastically reduced access to abortion. In 1984, the Boston Women's Health Book Collective released The New Our Bodies Ourselves, the first major revision of the book in a decade. The project to translate this version into Japanese began with a suggestion by outspoken feminist scholar Ueno Chizuko in 1986, which, along with the timing, positioned it as a post-DIB feminist project. The DIB movement sort of died out at some point in the late 70s and was sort of taken over by more academic feminism. And yet, the project involved women who had been active in the DIB movement and was supervised by Fujieda Miyoko, who had assisted with the 1974 translation of Our Bodies Ourselves around the same time as she was translating Kate Millett's Sexual Politics. This clearly positions the new translation in the same complex trajectory as earlier DIB discourse on women's health, in which the original translation had played such a key role. In stark contrast with the three women who, with some assistance, translated the 1973 version, some 50 women are credited as translators or editors of the new volume, making it more obviously the kind of collective project that created Our Bodies Ourselves in the first place. And like the American versions, the new translation included a full page of photos of these women, personalizing the translators and editors in the same way that the English language original had done for its contributors. This time, the translators and editors followed the wishes of the Boston Collective and attempted to faithfully and literally translate nearly the entire book, to which they assigned the more literally translated title, Bodies Ourselves. It was nonetheless a very engaged translation. Like its predecessor over a decade earlier, the translators and editors assert their presence throughout, beginning with a three-part foreword penned in turns by the three women in charge of translation and editing. While they continue to use anatomical illustrations from the original, according to the editors, most photographs have been replaced with photos taken in Japan, at least in part to make it easier for readers to relate. And more so than with the 1974 translation, the new version is full of locally relevant additions, one of which is a very large section on the lesbian community in Japan. The whole lesbian chapter was taken out for a lot of complicated reasons, but which I could discuss later. When the translation of the new Our Bodies Ourselves was published in 1988, as major and impressive an undertaking as it was, the expensive and awkwardly oversized volume, about it's bigger than a phone book, volume probably did not have the impact on awareness of women's health issues that the less substantial translation had 14 years earlier. To begin with, the earlier translation played a vital role in the formative years of the women's health movement in Japan, while by 1988, even if many doctors remained largely unwilling to cede control of women's bodies and health to women themselves, the information was far more readily available in numerous books and through various women's centers and organizations around the country. There is, however, a significant intervention this new translation made on the Japanese language itself. The Sino-Japanese compounds long used to refer to sexual organs contain the character for shame, chi, or for negative, in, creating a strong shameful or otherwise negative association with the parts of women's bodies associated with sex and reproduction. The translators replaced these characters with a more neutral character for sex, say, generating new words to talk about things like the vulva, the labia, pubic hair, and so forth. In so doing, the translators hoped to remove both the shame and euphemism that might prevent women from speaking openly about their own bodies. While all of the older terms remain in use today, most of the terms the translators introduced in this volume have increasingly become preferred, if not standard, in public discourse. I want to kind of change gears a little bit. Now, 3 years after Our Bodies Ourselves was first published commercially in the U.S., Sheer Heights Trailblazing The Height Report, a nationwide study of female sexuality, revealed the results of a survey of over 3,000 women across the U.S. on their sexual feelings, experiences, and opinions about masturbation, intercourse, clitoral stimulation, lesbianism, women's subservient role in sex with a man, the sexual revolution, older women's sexuality, and the changing nature of sex itself. What made this book meaningful to women in the U.S. was arguably not the statistics that Haidt tabulated, but respondents' often very intimate, sometimes very moving responses to Haidt's questions, ranging from brief sentences to lengthy paragraphs and collectively occupying the bulk of the text. These real and diverse women's voices showed the women reading the book both that they were not alone in their experiences and that there were other sexual possibilities open to them. An ostensibly complete, though arguably not engaged, Japanese translation was published the following year by Ishikawa Hiroyoshi, a male sociologist who had already published and translated prolifically on diverse topics that included sexuality, but nothing specifically focused on women or written from a feminist perspective. While analyzing Ishikawa's ability to translate intimate details of women's sexual lives is beyond the scope of my discussion here, and perhaps problematic because I'm not a woman, I only encountered one article critiquing having a man translate the text. This in an unsigned article in the lesbian feminist group Shining Wheels zine discussing the issue of translations by men in other of the 10 countries that had to date seen translations. The article makes no specific comments on Ishikawa's translation, however. This translation gave rise to significant public interest in similar local projects. For instance, the Height Report was the direct inspiration for More magazine to run a survey of its readers on women's lives and sex in 1980, which it released as the More Report in a thick hardcover volume in 1983, then in an abridged paperback form in 1985. Following Height's 1981 report on male sexuality, translated the following year into Japanese, ironically by a woman, Moore released its own report on male sexuality in 1984. And thus, through a series of translations and transfigurations of the Height Report, beginning in the late 1970s, and in the context of multiple translations and transfigurations of Our Bodies Ourselves, Japan saw a flowering of frank public discussion on female and male sexuality, wherein women were able to share anxieties as well as desires and to find a measure of affirmation and comfort. This was an exchange of ideas and experiences surrounding sexuality very much akin to what had been taking place within and advocated by the Lib movement in the 1970s. Unsurprisingly then, the Height Report in translation was also well received in the Lib community itself. The comments in the lesbian zine Shining Wheel about the text were similarly positive. I believe it is this prominent attention to the voices and experiences of lesbians that gave this book special meaning to some women in the lesbian community and ultimately led to its transfiguration into a project that would lead to Stories of Women Who Love Women, the first commercial publication produced by and for members of the lesbian community, whose reach would extend far beyond, with over 30,000 copies available at bookstores around the country. Published in 1987, again as part of the popular Besatz Takarajima series, the project that became Stories began as a pair of surveys conducted in late 1986 that drew in subtle and not so subtle ways on the Height Report and its transfigurations. The More Report surveys also contained questions about homosexuality, specifically among women in Japan, which suggest it might have been better suited as a direct model for the story surveys. However, the length and organization of this book makes it very difficult to find references to homosexual experiences and identity interspersed among the respondents' answers. Moreover, in the Height Report, lesbian experience is overtly politicized in such a way as to resonate with women in Japan who had begun to articulate what it might mean in Japan to be a lesbian feministo. Sawabe Hitomi, a self-identified lesbian feminist, who was the architect of and the driving force behind Stories, situates its genesis at the nexus of events in her own life. These included reading the lesbian feminist Marilyn Fry's The Politics of Reality with a small group of women who were considering translating it into Japanese, attending an international lesbian conference in Geneva, and then receiving around 100 letters in response to an article about the conference that she had published under a pseudonym in Fujin Koron. Her existing wish to become a reportage writer, on top of the letters in particular, overwhelmingly earnest in their various expression of loneliness and regret, as well as encouragement and excitement, instilled in Sawabe the desire to produce a book. Thus, while thinking and talking about about American lesbian feminist theory with other Japanese lesbian feminists, and her attendance at the Geneva Lesbian Conference formed a significant part of the context, the most forceful impetus for Stories seems to have been Sawabe's visceral reaction to the personal accounts of the experiences of women in Japan. In a recent oral history of her experiences in the lesbian community since the early 1970s, Sawabe makes no mention of the Height Report when she narrates the history of Stories. There are, however, several reasons why I position it in a fuzzy line of descent from Height's initial study and its earlier transfigurations. The most salient of these is in its naming. The title of the section of the book containing the surveys, Lesbian Report, A First for Japan, the Testimony of 234 Lesbians, almost certainly draws directly from the titles and subtitles of the volumes by both Height and Moore magazine in Japanese translation. To be sure, this titling could be an editorial intervention from the publisher. Indeed, the fact that Moore released a new or reformatted report each of the 4 years leading up to the publication of Stories certainly indicates an ongoing level of interest in these kind of reports that publishers would be keen to tap into. Yet, it is clear that Sawabe had the Height Report in mind when working on the survey. To begin, Shining Wheel, lesbian zine, which had noticed, as noted above, discussed the appropriateness of assigning a man to translate the book in the first place, was produced by a group of lesbian feminists which Sawabe herself founded. So it's obvious that Height's text had her attention soon after its publication in Japan. More saliently, when she sent out the questionnaires for the lesbian report, Sawabe enclosed copies from the Height Report for use as a reference, clearly showing potential respondents the kind of responses that she had in mind. Finally, while each of the three reports, Moore, Height, and Lesbian, frames the responses differently via categorization into chapters, they all rely on the same kinds of testimony about personal experiences and feelings. The testimony in Lesbian Report of a 25-year-old office worker specifically links the Height Report and Stories. She writes, "When I first read the Height Report, I was moved in a way I couldn't put into words. If this kind of book were published in Japan, it would be a big step for Japan's lesbian. Until now, the only way to touch the heart of lesbianism, politically, culturally, socially, has been through information from abroad. Hearing about lesbians abroad was very moving, but to hear directly from Japan's countless lesbians, for all women who are like that, it would provide them support." That looking back more than 20 years later, Sawabe did not indicate the Height Report was part of the history of Stories suggests to us that she did not read its lesbian chapter and then immediately set to work producing a Japanese version focused on lesbians. Nonetheless, I would argue that the circumstances surrounding its production, as well as at least in some case its reception, position Stories as a greatly transfigured version of the Height Report. Now, Height conducted this nationwide survey that became the Height Report in order to find out, quote, how American women themselves feel, what they like, what they think of sex, so that through this sharing, women would be able to see our personal lives more clearly, thus redefining our sexuality and strengthening our identities as women. A secondary goal of the book was, quote, to stimulate public discussion and reevaluation of sexuality. In her own preface to the results of the lesbian survey, Sawabe similarly explains that she created the survey to first, quote, convey as it is the existence of lesbians living in Japan, because we ourselves need to know the truth about our current situation. It's true that in America and in the countries of Europe, the lesbian feminism born out of the feminist movement has developed a great deal of power. We have a lot to learn from those lesbians, but I would like to begin with an understanding of our own current situation. Sawabe's second goal was to represent lesbians in all their diversity, which bears out in the great variety of individual and collective experiences represented in the book, both in the Lesbian Report itself, which comprises the second half of the book and in the remainder of the volume. The report, she writes, was created, quote, in order to shed light on our real selves and to reconsider and come to a new understanding of the lives of those of us who have continued to love women in the midst of extreme pressure from our heterosexual society, which only permits love between men and women. While the surveys that became the Lesbian Report marked the beginning of the story's project, as I said, they actually comprise only the second half of the book. The first half contains over a dozen articles on what the editors have described as living as lesbian, divided into sections on lesbian lives, lesbian experiences, lesbian beliefs, lesbian sex, lesbian groups and spaces, and last, lesbians abroad. And thus, in spite of having roots in a survey on the sexuality of women in the US, the content and order in which it is presented in stories positions the lives of local lesbians as being of foremost importance. Now I want to make a few concluding remarks. In Japan, the use by women of translation is part of efforts to rethink their status, as well as issues of reproduction, gender, and sexuality, was, to be sure, nothing new in the 1970s. By the 1910s, for instance, early feminists, such as members of Seitosha, the Blue Stocking Society, translated many kinds of texts as part of their own feminist project. Of course, translation is so thoroughly imbricated in so many aspects of Japan that it most often goes unremarked. In the introduction to new collection of essays on translation in Japan, Indra Levy writes that, quote, modern Japan is a cultural translation. The idea seems so self-evident as to require no further comments, and yet we have only begun to unravel its manifold implications. Like that collection, the majority of scholarship that falls under the rubric of translation studies in modern and contemporary Japan has been primarily focused on literary translation, particularly so in the case of scholarship on the 20th century and on the present. As my talk today illustrates, however, I would suggest by way of example that attention to the translation and more dramatic transfiguration of other kinds of text is essential to more fully understanding how even fundamental constructs, such as the meaning of the category woman, have continued to evolve. This is so even in cases where, as with the Lib movement, the majority of those involved see translation as having played only a minor role, if any. Within translation studies, as well as within studies of globalization, transculturation, and so on, as I have begun to show today, there is no question that transformations as things, ideas, practices, people transit from culture to culture, they illustrate the agency of people on the ground, what Valentine Mogadam, among others, have described as globalization from below. Situating these translation projects in the context of acts of transfiguration, I would argue, urges us to carry our queries further, to pursue the ripples of change beyond the obvious. Thus, the texts and their translations and other transfigurations shown in this slide do not represent an endpoint, but rather jumping off points, which time precludes me from discussing further today, but which I explore in my book. To even begin to suggest the waves of transfiguration engendered in part by these transfiguration projects, I would need to somehow fit on the slides the countless articles in commercial magazines and zines, as well as dozens upon dozens of books, along with demonstrations and consciousness-raising groups, women's health centers, attendance at UN conferences, counter-conferences, and so on and so forth ad infinitum, as well as, in some way, how women's self-understandings and identifications, along with the very meaning of the category of woman in Japan, were transfigured through these and myriad other acts of exchange with counterparts abroad. Thank you.